50928, Crystal Clear Special Utility. All right. Mr. Bates, you're on, sir.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. There's a laundry list of reasons that the preliminary injunction here should be reversed, but resolving this case by addressing how the district court misapplied 1926B or improperly presumed essential elements of Crystal Clear's burden of proof would miss a crucial opportunity. The real central issue squarely presented here is that under Gregory v. Ashcroft, 1926B simply does not reach state regulators like the PUC. Because it does not, there's no such thing as a 1926B defense against state regulation.
You need to speak up or something.
Apologies, Your Honor, I will. I'm not used to how loud I am on the microphone. Apologies. Because it does not reach state regulators, there's no such thing as a 1926B defense against state regulation of an indebted utility CCN. Green Valley and North Alamo before it left this issue open. And Congress never meant 1926B to prevent states from regulating local utility monopolies that the states themselves define. It certainly never meant 1926B to shift that regulatory function away from the states to federal district courts, but that's effectively what the Western District has endorsed, given this court's silence. So it's time for this court to answer once and for all the key question that North Alamo and Green Valley left undecided. So let's turn to it. The correct interpretation of 1926B excludes state regulators. How do we know? Because the Supreme Court has prescribed a clear statement rule, the so-called federalism canon of interpretation, that 1926B does not pass. Now, the paradigmatic case here is Gregory, but there's a clearer statement of Gregory's rule that comes in a later case, Pennsylvania Department of Corrections v. Yeske, where the Supreme Court phrased it this way: absent an unmistakably clear expression of intent to alter the usual constitutional balance between the states and the federal government, we will interpret a statute to preserve rather than destroy the state's substantial sovereign powers. The Gregory provides a clear example, obviously.
So your argument is the issue that was left open in Green Valley, the statutory textual issue of whether or not regulators themselves can curtail, is obvious because?
It's obvious because Congress did not address it. There is no clear statement, and as Gregory shows us, let me address that for a moment if you would. The question there was about the Age Discrimination and Employment Act and whether it applied to state judges. The analysis in Gregory shows us the way the rule operates, and that is the absence of congressional intent clearly stated is determinative.
As any, 1926B litigations all over the country, and as you're encouraging, should be more in Texas state courts. Courts like Mountain Peak. Has any court, state or federal, ever stated what you're stating to us, that we should construe it to mean the curtailment cannot be done by a regulator?
So there are 60 federal appellate decisions, and that's the case body that I'm familiar with. Yeah. Not one of them holds that 1926B extends to the state, to a state.
Does any regulator of them hold that it exempts a state regulator?
No, this question it's remained open since North Alamo noticed it the first time around. No one has addressed it, but the overwhelming majority of 1926B litigation goes between utilities and municipalities. It doesn't address, and this is one of the features of the Western District's docket that is relatively unique within the country, is they are suing the state regulator for exercising its regulatory function. That's exactly the type of traditional sphere that we presume Congress did not mean.
And yet, am I right, and I appreciated this, on pages 33 to 35, you're saying the PUC is mistaken, that it shouldn't itself apply.
That is our position, and certainly I have had long discussions with the PUC and its counsel about how they ought to be interpreting the water code provision. They view it as a full stop prohibition.
And you say, but correct me if I'm wrong, just for time, yes, sure. You say actually it's not a full stop. In fact, the federal and the state law can be harmonized.
That's correct.
And they should do it in the first instance?
That is my belief, but...
How do we achieve that so that the concerns that you may think are valid, that they say, well, at least there's got to be some way to vindicate the supremacy clause? In other words, if they can't sue the regulator, they've got to be some way that they can avoid what is a true curtailment.
But I would push back on that very slightly. I want to get to your question, but the question that presumes is whether the PUC acting is a curtailment within the meaning of the statute at all.
Okay.
And because, so first of all.
And we left this open in Green Valley.
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely.
Okay, so Green Valley is pretty central to our decision here, correct?
I completely agree.
Okay, but I have a series of questions.
Yes, Your Honor.
And because I'm assuming you two are very prepared. Green Valley has since, in July, late July, been interpreted and applied in a published decision written by Edith Jones.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why didn't you 28J that to us?
Because this issue, because they actually, Green Valley was...
We're talking about Dobbin?
...was not applied because Dobbin was a standing case. They determined that
right,
there was
but
no
a lot of this is, you yourself are saying this court didn't have equity jurisdiction. So a lot of the question here is when? When can a federally indebted utility actually complain? And jurisdiction features very significantly. And now, since you didn't brief, and neither did they, Dobbin, my question is this. If you're right and you can't sue the PUC, but now we have Dobbin on the books, which says too late to sue the competitor once PUC has authorized the curtailment, that really sounds like the loophole.
That's not a loophole. That's not a loophole because the PUC regulating the boundaries of a CCN is not a violation of 1926. And the involvement of the state acting in its regulatory capacity cuts off 1926B's effect. What happens after that, whether or not there's...
Let's say you were representing Crystal Clear. And let's assume they have no pipes in the ground physical capability problem.
Yes, sir.
So I know you're disputing that. But so the government gets protection for its debt if there's any reduction of its service area. When can they step in and assert the conflict preemption?
My first answer is when the PUC does it, there is no preemption. Because 1926B simply does not encompass the exercise of the regulatory function. When the PUC, let me put it very simply, when the PUC does it, it's not a curtailment within the meaning of the statute. The statute doesn't just say shall not be curtailed or limited. It says shall not be curtailed or limited by. Part of our argument, and
no state court, no federal court has ever exempted regulators, and now you're saying when you pair it up with Dobbin, that means they can never assert federal law supremacy.
I disagree with that.
Okay, but when then? Just tell me practically how they could.
When they sue 1926 has a large field of scope remaining after you say, hey, the PUC is not involved. Any time that if the city of Seguin hauls off and decides to start providing service willy-nilly in Crystal Clear's district, they can go to federal court and get an injunction.
But now we're just writing a blueprint. The city gets to go to the PUC and says, why don't you cleanse it for us? Because then it's not reviewed.
That's not this court writing a blueprint. That is Congress, by having failed to clearly identify its intent to intrude on what is a core state regulatory function. That's exactly what Gregory tells us. Let me give the court an example. In researching this case, I found we do not have an application of Gregory to 1926 itself, but we do have the next best thing, the application of a parallel clear statement rule. So the case is Freemanville Water System v. Porchban. It's an 11th Circuit case from 2009.
This is in your brief.
It is not.
Okay.
I did not find
since
it.
Since you have limited time, I mean, unless
this
the
is,
other
I believe
if you didn't brief it, I have too many questions on things you did brief. So your opposing counsel, for example, cited Pittsburgh County.
Yes.
In their brief. You don't discuss it in your principal brief. You don't discuss it in the reply brief. Do you agree with that, or would you say that's a flawed decision?
No. Pittsburgh is right as far as it goes. But here's the distinction. In Oklahoma, the state has delegated its state regulatory function to local government entities. We do not dispute 1926B applies to local governments.
Okay, so this is consistent. Your argument is just Texas has, I'm going to phrase it aggressively, so push back. Texas has eviscerated the Supremacy Clause because it told its regulators you can't respect federal law, and now in turn you're saying Congress forgot to say they're included too.
I am going to push back.
Good.
Because the first question is whether or not 1926, and the preemption, again, is not about what Texas intended to tell its people. It's what Congress intended, and that comes from the statutory text. There is no clear indication, no direct, specific, unequivocal indication in the text of 1926 to indicate Congress meant to get to state regulators. In that context, we have to assume they did not.
I thought you're more, the argument that I found more authority to support is that it does apply. These utilities have to have their loans protected, but state law, not federal law, not requiring an interpretation of federal law, but state law, this provision 2541 or whatever, that can be interpreted, as you put in your brief, several ways. One of which is that it's not the North Alamo rule. It's not a presumption just because they got the CCU. Instead, you've got to confirm first they are giving service to the area. Why isn't that the logical reconciliation as opposed to this aggressive Texas's outside of federal orbit?
So the reason that I think that the statutory construction case is probably the more important one is first of all, it's a pure statutory construction question. Instead of preemption, which is ultimately an application of the Supremacy Clause, therefore constitutional. So as a matter of constitutional avoidance, I think the statutory question comes first. Second, I will candidly admit that's not how the PUC is applying 13.2541D. I think they're mistaken. I think part of the reason that this is undeveloped by the Texas courts is because the Western District has taken this over.
Yeah.
And there simply is not the litigation going through the Texas system.
Well, and I was sympathetic, and I have a few questions, and I don't mean to dominate, but I'm in your brief, in the principal brief, you mentioned Pullman abstention, and then you mentioned Younger versus Harris. Then when we get to the reply brief, you're talking about yet more abstention doctrine. Do you recall on page 8, you quote Burford?
Yes, Your
Honor. Well, a lot of that seemed fairly concerning to me, convincing, and I'm going to ask opposing counsel about that, but that's you disputing that this court had equity jurisdiction because it should be decided by state courts.
So
where does that take us logically?
Logically, I believe that we should, that if 1926 applies to the PUC, these issues should be raised in response to a release petition before the PUC. My read of the Water Code says the PUC can dispose of the vast majority of these instances. The two cases, they're not perfectly aligned, but they're aligned enough that when a property is receiving water service, it is having service made available. Conversely, when it's not receiving service, it's not having service made available. And in either of those instances, the PUC can act. It's when there is some theoretical conflict.
But you see the direction of mine, picking up on multiple abstention arguments you are making in your briefs, sensitive to the fact that federal courts shouldn't intrude into complex regulatory areas like Texas Water Code. Why wouldn't we dismiss the case to let the state courts do just what you're asking us to let them do?
I actually made exactly that similar pitch to Judge Ezra below, and if that's what the court wants to do, I have no problem with that.
Okay.
The only concern that gives me is, again, it kicks the can down the road
on
a question that Green Valley left open and leaves that to the Texas courts to resolve as a matter of federal law.
Judge Jones in Dobbin is really saying that's where it ought to be. That's exactly your argument.
Well, her point, I think, is that the application of 1926B should be done through the Texas courts. The meaning of 1926B is an appropriate question for this court to answer, I would submit. However, if the reasoning of the court below does not have equitable jurisdiction to enjoin because of abstention doctrines or any other basis, I'll take that.
Yeah, it's difficult. Thank you. Keep going. I've asked you a million questions.
No problem. Your Honor, I really would, and again, let me throw myself on the mercy of the court. I apologize for not having found Freemanville, but I think it's very important for the court to consider.
All right. Well, go give us the site.
The site is 563 F3rd 1205. The case there is that a utility sued an Indian tribe.
Did you give it to them?
I have not. I only found this in preparation for oral argument. Apologize. And I do not,
I'm sorry, 563 Federal 3rd what?
1205, ma'am.
Okay.
So the utility sues an Indian tribe under 1926B, claiming its service is being curtailed. The tribe responds by pleading sovereign immunity. And so the 11th Circuit applies a literally parallel clear statement rule to the one that we're advocating for to decide whether Congress intended to abrogate. And here's what they said. Ambiguity is the enemy of abrogation, and the critical part of 1926B is ambiguous. Specifically, the statute's silence about who it reaches does not clearly and unequivocally demonstrate that Congress intended 1926B to encompass, to reach Indian tribes and thereby imply abrogation. And if your honors will allow me, the only thing that is unmistakably clear to us is that the statutory language does not make it unmistakably clear that it applies to tribes. And the same thing is true about whether that same language covers state regulators. I will reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, sir. All right, Mr. Green.
May it please the court. So, at the outset,
had you read Dobbin?
Yes, I have read Dobbin.
Why not 28J? It's an application of Green Valley. I'm just startled. Both sides would think wouldn't alert it to us, but you think it has zero relevance to the discussion?
The court in the Dobbin case did not hold that you can't sue the PUC pre-decertification. What the court in Dobbin held was now that there has been decertification, there's nothing redressable for the federal court to do.
So but if they're right on their interpretation of 1926, and Dobbin's right as to you can't go after the competitor, when are you supposed to vindicate 1926B?
You do exactly what we did here. You go to federal court and get a preliminary injunction to stop the decertification from happening in the first place. That's what you need to do. Because under Dobbin, if you fail to do that...
Well, now under Dobbin, but you didn't even brief Dobbin. We didn't know that.
That's right. We didn't know that. But we made the correct strategic call, it turns out.
Unless this case that they didn't brief says what they said it does, which then would argue almost an anti-commandeering type thing, which is Congress never expected to sort of push out Texas water regulators.
It sounds like, and I'm not familiar with this case, it never came up in my research, all the searches I did under 1926B, I'm not even certain what circuit it is. But it sounds like that's a situation where we're not talking about municipal competitors or similar providers.
But the PUC isn't a municipal competitor.
Right, that's exactly right. But the PUC is coming in and curtailing so that the municipality can serve. And so that's what's happening in the...
Well, I'm going to correct you there. Factually, am I right? We don't even know what the PUC is going to do. All we've got is a staff recommendation to decertify. But they may do just what eventually happened in Mount... I can't remember the name. You didn't brief it. They did brief it. So it's not in your brief. So I don't have any insight what you think. You know the case I'm talking about.
Is this the Mountain Peak case?
Yeah. That's an important case here.
The PUC, and I represent multiple utilities on this issue. Our firm does in front of the PUC. And under these circumstances, they have never denied decertification. They view it as we have to decertify as long as the utility is not present.
That's how they interpret 2541.
That's exactly right. And so we know that...
Here we just have a staff recommendation. There's a lot of flux post-Green Valley. Can we, federal courts, intrude at this point? We don't know that you're telling us because you represent these people that you never win, but...
We do know, and we established a substantial likelihood that would happen, and here's why we know. Prior to entering the TRO, temporary restraining order.
When you say you establish a substantial likelihood, am I correct, Judge Ezra? It's only 13 pages. He never finds substantial likelihood of irreparable harm. He presumes that. Is that right?
No, I disagree with that.
Okay.
But here's what actually happened at the TRO level. Judge Ezra asked the PUC, are you willing to stand down and not grant this so that we have time to go through this and do the preliminary injunction process? And the PUC said no. And so the PUC informed the court that it was going to proceed and, in fact, grant the decertification. That's what they do. That's
just. You just add, and in fact, grant? Is that your words? Or did they say and grant? That's important.
Right. I don't have the transcript, but that's my recollection of what happened at that hearing. And again, we go to this substantial likelihood of prevailing on the merits. Part of that, in order to establish standing, we show that they are threatening to curtail. And so we can look at the PUC conduct that, under the circumstances of this case, the PUC, as a matter of course, always grants. The staff, in fact, said, yes, PUC grant. And that is, in fact, what was going to happen as a practical matter. And so we know that curtailment's coming just based on history, based on the staff recommendation, and based on the PUC saying we're not standing down, we're moving forward. And then we also know what happened afterwards is the PUC continues to defend the curtailment that's coming. They're not saying to the court, oh, but we weren't planning on curtailing at all. Representing the PUC officials, they're saying, we think we should be able to curtail. They're moving forward. So back to dogma.
But they might grant a decertification on grounds unrelated to 1926B. They might just say, we've looked at the facts, it's very intensive, and you don't have, you aren't servicing in this area with water.
Well, they always grant decertification ignoring 1926B, because Texas law says, number one, ignore it, and number two, you decertify as long as there's no.
But my point is they could decertify without presenting this federalism issue.
Right, and that's the conflict. Federal law says do not curtail.
Right.
State law and the state agency says we're going to curtail and we're curtailing it. So that's why we have conflict preemption, because we have an absolute prohibition.
Well, you've described what you think state law says we're going to curtail, but it is a little more nuanced. It says you may not deny it based on. And so why couldn't that be read as opposing counsel suggests in their brief, which it means it's just not the old North Alamo row. It's not a presumptive denial period if they have the CCU. Now you've got to look at the fact questions first and then consider 1926B.
Well, as they concede, that's not how the PUC interprets it. The PUC does interpret it to mean we don't consider it at all.
Where in this record do we have that? Because Mountain Peak, the state court isn't acting as if the PUC has that absolute rule. They considered the 1926B issue.
They did, but not as an administrative review of any decisions the PUC made. The court in Mountain Peak was very clear in what it was doing, that this is not a decision that the PUC made, but it's an independent claim under federal law that the utility is entitled to federal protections. So that's what's happening. You have two states, federal court, state court, with parallel jurisdiction over this issue. And a federal court has an unflagging duty to consider the cases within its jurisdiction.
But the state court has an equal duty to vindicate the federal constitution.
Yes.
And it sounds like from the one case we've given, they know that. We all may be talking about the PUC has decided to interpret it badly, but is there a state court that has similarly said there's a physical impossibility to comply with the two? That's what we need for a conflict preemption. Has any state, Texas state court, actually said that?
No. And I agree that state courts, if we were to file this claim in state court, they would have an unflagging duty
yes.
to consider it as well.
So
yes.
Why not file it there?
Because under NOPC, under the U.S. Supreme Court case of NOPC, the fact that the state court would also have an unflagging duty doesn't detract from the federal court's unflagging duty. Now, it's okay. Virtually unflagging duty.
Okay, but
because
but,
preemption.
And I know you want to keep talking, but then you're getting sort of close to what he said he'd accept as an outcome, which is we abstain. You don't lose the case in federal court, but we acknowledge it's a complex regulatory structure, and let's get a state court determination. What's wrong with that? Because I think you only answered it in footnote 7 with no authority.
The first response on abstention, and in fact, really all of these supremacy arguments, is that was never raised below. They never.
I know, but it's before us. We
abstain. So the court doesn't have the record on abstention below. But when we look at the concept of abstention, there is no court, there is no federal court in the country that in the 1926B context said we need to abstain and let the state court decide.
Well, we're the Fifth Circuit.
And no court has done that.
It is really exploring states' rights and federalism. So let's talk about Pullman abstention. Wouldn't all three elements be met? We have a state law clash with the Constitution. The state law is definitely not clear how to interpret 2541. And third, clarity would obviate this. Seems like all three elements are met.
I don't think that the key, as in Pullman, is state law interpretation. The key is federal law interpretation. Does it preempt the state law? So this is not a Pullman situation. Well, what we're really arguing about is, well, what is the scope of the Texas law? What we're arguing about is, does conflict preemption apply? Now, this is important to say because in their briefing, they said the only thing we're challenging is 13.2541D as far as preemption. We're saying the whole decertification is preempted by federal law because federal law says don't curtail. We satisfy federal law. We're making service available. We can provide service within a reasonable time after request for service.
The
judge has found that. That's right. But under the standard review for preliminary injunction, that's not clearly erroneous. So we are making available water service. That's the context we're talking about. The federal law says in that situation, the service area shall not be curtailed or limited. It does not limit it to certain actors. It's a broad prohibition. And on that point,
you have since there is a law in 1920s, there's an ALR on this, there's a lot of litigation. Do you have any other circuit that's ever applied it to a state regulator?
No. And I think the reason why is because Texas is the only state that passed a law that said PUC ignore federal law.
That gets me back to that's the law we need to have interpreted because we tend to avoid constitutional decisions. One way would be to actually ascertain whether that law means what you say it means.
It's already been interpreted. The Mountain Peak Court held that the 1926B issue just looks at this present capability concept. The state law on decertification just looks at, are there actual facilities that are directed towards it? So the state courts have already said what these laws mean, and in our situation, the federal law says don't curtail, and the state law says curtail. That's already been decided. I think what Your Honor is getting at as far as what hasn't been decided is how do we work with a subsection D that says PUC ignore the federal law?
I don't read D to say go ahead and curtail.
Right, that's right. It's B. It's the decertification statute itself that says when you meet these criteria, PUC, you need to decertify. What D says, and ignore federal law if it's contrary. And so we are seeking to strike down D because its only application is in conflict with the supremacy clause. But our preemption argument goes at the decertification itself. That's why we're seeking an injunction, not just against subsection D, but against the PUC actually curtailing the service area when federal law says you can't curtail it. So going back to the abstention question, it does not meet the factors because the key question before the Fifth Circuit on these 1926B issues is our satisfaction of the standard under federal law. Are we making service available? And if we meet that standard, federal law applies to say it shall not be curtailed. Now, that concept of shall not be curtailed and does that extend to a state? The appellant references a footnote in U.S. v. Brown that talks about a general rule that says, well, if it doesn't mention the state, we make a presumption that it doesn't apply. But then in the very next sentence, this court gave the exception to that, which is when the extension of that law to the state government is in the benefit of the federal government and the public. 1926B case law consistently across the board, looking at statements of congressional intent, has held that the purposes of 1926B, The reason why curtailment is prohibited is because we're defending the federal government's interests in loans and because of the public interest in all the rural customers who are hoping to benefit by those additional members in that property closer to the city. So it's clear that when we have that shall not be curtailed, that broad shall not be curtailed or limited, that applies to state, and like Your Honor said in questioning appellant, otherwise it's an enormous loophole. And this court has consistently said we're not going to allow loopholes in the protection of 1926B. The City of Madison case unambiguously prohibits any curtailment or limitation in favor of the city. Post Oak in 1996, Judge King was on that panel, that there are no exceptions in the statute against this curtailment prohibition. Seventh Circuit, the Jennings case, strong language of the statute prohibiting curtailment. The McAllister case in 2004, any local or state action that would operate to curtail the service area in favor of a city.
You do represent these rural utilities a lot.
Yes.
Do you know of any that have actually defaulted on their federal loan?
None of my clients have. I can say that for sure.
That's the risk.
That's the risk, because under that argument, if this didn't apply to the state, then conceivably a city could extend its boundaries all the way through the rural utility, decertify the entire area, and then the utility has no assets left with which to pay the loan. That's conceivable. Under that argument, it doesn't extend to the state. The loophole that they're trying to accomplish here is they bifurcate the competition into two. The PUC comes in and curtails, saying, well, we're not subject to the statute, we can do it. And then the city comes in on its heels and starts providing service.
That loophole only works, and I may not, again, we haven't had briefing on Dobbin. That loophole really only works if Dobbin stands in its present statement, correct? Because but for Dobbin, you would be able to sue when the competitors then tried to take their PUC approval.
I think the impact of Dobbin in future cases is still unclear. What we know from Dobbin is that if we hadn't obtained the preliminary injunction to stop the decertification, we would not have a redressable harm against the PUC. Thankfully, this is not that case.
Fortunately, Dobbin was correctly decided?
I think that the court in Dobbin missed one key point, and I think that was may have been because I don't think it was Texas Council representing the utility. I don't know. But they missed a key point about the review of the agency action, that the PUC was actually still enforcing the decertification at state court. So they weren't finished with the decertification process. That's the one thing I think the court missed. But I agree with Dobbin that when the PUC is done with the decertification, a city can serve without having to get PUC consent. That's true. And so that's why it's so critical in these cases to get the preliminary injunction, to preserve the status quo so that we still have redressable relief against the PUC officials under Ex parte Young. So all of this, the point being on all of this is the case law, the text, everything points towards, yes, the PUC is regulated, and the state decertification is conflicting with the federal protection against decertification. One quick point on that I don't want to lose sight of, the spending clause. That's the basis for the federal power here to tell states and localities you can't curtail. The Texas legislature has enacted a statute, Texas Water Code 49.153, that allows its utilities to take federal debt. Having done that, they can't turn around and say, but we can curtail you because we're the state government. They accept the money. The state of Texas has enacted a law that accepts the money. They have to take the prohibitions under 1926B that comes with that 1926A money. If the state of Texas doesn't like the federal law, the federal protection against curtailment, the answer is not to pass a law that says they can just ignore that protection. The answer is to repeal the law that allows utilities to take federal debt. If you don't want the protections, if you don't want to be kept from curtailing, then don't let the utilities take the federal debt in the first place.
But I thought at the same time they were saying they definitely know they owe fair compensation.
Well, my experience in the PUC to date is that they don't provide compensation based on the federal loan. And what essentially would be happening is the federal court would just have to be trusting that the PUC is going to compensate for the loan, but that's up to the PUC. And the USDA could very easily find that it wasn't compensated at the state court level and it can't be repaid because the utility service area has been curtailed. That's the problem with that sort of approach. So,
could USDA be in this case by invitation?
They certainly could be. What's interesting about this case is the USDA isn't here and the PUC isn't here. It's the developer taking this case before. And so unfortunately, this court doesn't have an attorney standing up representing the federal government, nor does it have an attorney representing the state government. And I would again point the court to the fact that these issues were not raised. In fact, these issues of supremacy, they were raised by the PUC in its response to the motion to dismiss, not on the preliminary injunction. And so for the court to take this up for the first time, it would essentially be allowing a motion to dismiss to be considered on interlocutory appeal. Just like the en banc court in Green Valley looked at the issue and said, we don't need to decide that now, send it back down to remand and let the proceedings continue, this court can do that on this issue of supremacy as well.
Wait, spell that out again?
Yeah, certainly. So the en banc court in Green Valley, the majority certainly had the ability to decide this issue. They opted not to, and it from the case, it appeared the reason why is because there were still all these issues to be decided down at the district court. They looked at just the making service available concept, now let the district court hash out these issues. The same thing can apply here. These are very significant questions as far as
how would we get them hashed out, particularly how would we get state courts to hash them out first?
Well, as far as the federal law and supremacy clause, and then should, given the strength of the supremacy clause, is abstention appropriate? And in order to decide if abstention's appropriate, there's these factors that would need to be considered, and we haven't had the opportunity to go through those factors. So again, this was not raised below. The PUC is not here in the first place. Dobbin doesn't speak to it because Dobbin was speaking just in the context of a post-decertification level of relief. It's critical to end, it is critical that federal courts have the power to enforce federal law. And the answer is not state courts can do it too. The answer is because it's a federal law issue, the federal court should step in and decide when the case is before them that the supremacy clause applies, conflict preemption applies, because we are making service available, our service area can't be curtailed.
We've had multiple opportunities to vindicate federal law on this provision, and this court hasn't.
This court has absolutely vindicated federal law.
Not in Green Valley.
In Green Valley, it remanded down, but it set the standard that needed to be considered in the context of the PUC being a defendant. Same thing in Dobbin. PUC was a defendant. The court didn't say PUC is not a proper defendant. Same thing in all of the state court cases against the PUC, the Mountain Peak, for instance. PUC is there as a defendant. The court doesn't say, wait a minute, the PUC is not subject to this law. Instead, they decided the issue based on the merits, not on PUC is not subject. So we would ask the court to hold there was no reversible error here and to affirm the grant of the preliminary injunction.
All right, before you leave, since we've had the issue of the Freemanville, which I thought he said was from the 11th Circuit, that only came up in argument, and then Dobbin as well. So he's coming up for his rebuttal, but from my eyes, it seems warranted that post the arguments that you all file a letter brief at least addressing some of arguably what's been raised today, as well as, you know, the cases that are wet ink and all that, and do that. But any of them, and he's still getting his rebuttal, but I'm just, you know, it's a important issue to put it mildly, but I mean, it's sort of a moving target near a lot of other pieces in it, and what we have below is the issuance of a preliminary injunction. You've got this tension between federal and state, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of subterranean issues here that need to be clearly fleshed out so the panel knows exactly what we need to decide and don't need to decide at the end of the day. Okay, so anyway, thank you for your argument. All right, come back up, counsel. That was not meant to pre-admit your rebuttal, but just before I forgot to say it.
If I might, just offer my apology again for not having provided 28J on material on this. I'm a little gun shy of doing so, having been chastised by prior panels for raising things after the briefing is done. So I apologize.
But if it's an intervening case.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that was this 2 weeks ago.
Dobbin, in my assessment, because it was on the standing issue, and I appreciate that the court would have preferred that we brought it up. And again, you have my apologies.
Well, it's no harm, no foul, and it's axiomatic. You take your panels like you find, you know, and you research your panels just like folk research them, you know, and I know that. So, you know, when you figure out your panel, you go for it. You know, I just leave it at that. So,
anyway,
it's better for us to have the information beforehand. But anyway, we know. But that's, again, that's why we argue in the case, so we can figure it out.
So let me begin by talking about the PUC's position, because I recognize the fact they're not here is a little surprising. The PUC made its position on this perfectly crystal clear to the district court below. 1926B, by its plain language, does not prohibit a state regulator's release of property pursuant to the requirements of state utility law. Record 457. If you want to see what the PUC tells this court, I would commend the appellee's brief that they filed in the Dobbin case, where they make the same kind of statements. 1926B does not require the commissioners to consider federal indebtedness when entertaining a release petition.
You've said that's wrong. Page 33.
No. 1926 does not require them to consider federal indebtedness because the PUC is not covered. They're not talking about the water code provision, Your Honor. They're saying the PUC is telling this court in the Dobbin brief that they filed, 1926 does not apply to state regulators. It is exactly the same argument that we're making. So to the extent that there's any concern about the PUC.
Again, 33 to 35, you keep saying PUC is mistaken.
About the meaning of the water code provision.
Oh, no, I think you say the 1926B defense should be considered by them.
If it applies to the PUC at all, which we reject. And if the court holds as a matter of definitive construction of 1926B, then yes, the PUC should consider it.
I guess I come back to my first question. If you were representing these rural utilities, when do they get to have 1926B vindicated?
As against the PUC, they do not.
But then if Dahl is right, who can they sue?
As against the PUC, against regulatory action engaged in by the state in its regulatory capacity, 1926 does not reach that. You guys keep assuming that it's a
curtailment. I'm the utility, and you're telling me, since you can't go after the PUC, how do you protect your service area? What's your legal advice to me?
As against the PUC is left by 1926B with full discretion to regulate the boundaries of CCNs because Congress did not reach the state regulators.
And eliminate the collateral the federal government has?
Take this for instance.
What's the answer to that question?
I don't believe that there is the risk of...
But they could legally on your theory.
Yes, I'm going to put a stake in the ground on that. It's unfortunate, but you know, it's not as a theoretical consequence.
Hearing argument. The spending clause can't tell them. Is that
no? It is not. I am not arguing congressional power. I'm arguing that Congress did not exercise it in this particular statute. We are not making a constitutional argument saying Congress can't do this. We're saying Congress didn't do this, and that goes to Gregory. I apologize. I see that I'm out. If I may.
Madam Clerk, give him 2 minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. First of all, liberal construction principles, and that's exactly what we're talking about protecting purpose-based liberal construction principles, they don't trump Gregory's rule. And we can tell that from Gregory itself. Gregory's about the ADEA. It is a remedial statute. It is given a broad liberal construction for similar reasons that we have this year. But we can tell from the fact that the Supreme Court still insisted on a clear statement means that liberal construction cannot trump it. It also means that when we're talking about whether the scope of a federal statute encompasses or intrudes on these traditional state functions, liberal construction doesn't define that scope. What defines that scope is Congress's actual text. Here, the statute gives a what, non-curtailment, a how, by particular methods, and it leaves the who silent. At best, that's ambiguous. And here's what Gregory says about ambiguity. Oh, if I can find it. In the face of ambiguity, we will not attribute to Congress an intent to intrude on state governmental functions. That ends the inquiry. Congress did not say any municipality, utility, or state regulator shall not curtail. It said nothing that tells us it gets that curtailment gets to state regulators in the first place. So when the PUC manages CCN boundaries in the using universal and neutral criteria for regulating in its regulatory capacity, Congress didn't mean to reach that. That's just the simple fact of it. Now, I will say on the question of preemption, if the court decides to go down the preemption route, in addition to the question about the proper construction of the water code provision, there's the ultimate question is this an unacceptable obstacle at all? And I would commend to your analysis the district court's opinion in Green Valley itself, where Judge Sparks looked at this question and said, simply delaying the consideration to state courts, where we know that they're going to take this issue up, he didn't say this word, but it's effectively it's a speed bump, not an unacceptable obstacle. And the case that we argued that same principle under in our brief is the petroleum exploration case, the PSC of Kentucky, decision from the Supreme Court. The holding there is on irreparable harm, but I think it's illustrative of saying this is not a problem to leave these questions to the state court, even if it's arguably preempted. Thank you, Your Honors. Appreciate the time this morning.
All right. Thank you, Counsel. As I adverted to, I'm going to direct that within 10 days, Counsel files simultaneous letter briefs, not strictly a 28J, because that's just citing the cases, but now that you've fleshed it up, you've heard the questions from the panel, et cetera, so simultaneous letter brief, inclusive of Dobbins, Freemansville case, and any other
abstention,
you know, in the brief. I mean, the object, we just want to get it right. And so, you know, there's tension between all these doctrines. Now that you've heard the questions, you kind of know to flesh those out as well. And we have sort of the oddity, I guess you will, two very important parties not in the case, the PUC, the government's not here, PUC, so, you know, we're a little cabined, well, concerned about what we say and how we say, particularly because of the nature of the way it comes to it. But we are very mindful that it's up here on the issuance of a preliminary injunction, which these days seem to be radioactive in the Fifth Circuit, I shall say, it's my terms, but they're radioactive in every sense of the word. So we're very sensitive, you know, in terms of trying to get it right. But it's helpful that you're giving to us kind of the on the ground of what happens, because otherwise this is sort of an abstraction for us. But because y'all do this, it's helpful for us to kind of know. So what did I say, 10 days, not more than, I don't know. I'm gonna trust your judgment. Don't rewrite these, okay? So I'm not gonna put a page in it, but just be reasonable, it's narrowed down. Don't reiterate what's in here, but mainly these new cases and the nuances of the issues raised, and that'll be helpful, okay? Once those are filed, the case will be submitted. We'll get it decided as best we can, okay?
All right, that completes the cases that are docketed for this morning. Those along with the non-orally argued cases will be submitted. Having said that, the West Coast Courtroom panel will be in recess until 9 a.m. in the morning.